Be seated. Good morning. As you can see, our panel has changed. To my right now is Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm still Leanne Dofino. So, Deborah.
May it please the court, this case looks very different today than it did when you remanded it following a summary judgment 3 years ago. And if I may, I'll take about 5 minutes to put the issues in context and set the stage for the court. The case, as you will recall, involves a dispute about a long-term natural gas contract in which Quiksilver agreed to sell and CMS agreed to buy 10,000 MMBTUs of gas every day for 10 years at a price of $2.47 per MMBTU. And the parties also agreed to a special condition that was related to sharing additional value if the gas could be scheduled or delivered to derive additional value. And that term is the central issue in the dispute in this litigation. Now, in the summary judgment appeal, the court held that that special condition was a definite and enforceable term and remanded the case for trial, but did not interpret the special condition. And at the same time, the court remanded a tag-along fraud claim and a rescission claim for trial. The court gave us guidance on the controlling law, recognizing that Michigan law governed the case, and it recognized that the rule in Michigan for rescission was that rescission would be available in cases of mutual mistake or unilateral mistake induced by fraud. So on remand, everyone knew the rules and what Quiksilver would be required to prove. Now, Quiksilver knew it had a contract case about a dispute over the meaning of that special condition and not a fraud case. And quite reasonably, Quiksilver tried this case as a contract case. It made no effort to prove that CMS's representatives who made the statements at issue didn't intend to perform them at the time they were made. It did not even call the CMS representatives who made those representations in the plaintiff's case. This record has none of the confessions or contradictions or smoking guns that are essential to a fraud case. It simply is not a fraud case, and that's why Quiksilver has been unable to cite evidence of fraud. What you have here is a classic case, as exemplified by this court's decision in Miga versus Jensen, of a dispute over the meaning of an agreement. And this court's ruling in MEGA, citing a long line of Texas authority that disputes over the meaning of a contract cannot be evidence of fraud, controls the case. Because Quiksilver hadn't called the CMS representatives whose conduct is at issue with respect to the fraud claim, CMS called them in the defense case, and they unanimously and without contradiction explained that the parties had agreed to a concept called physical arbitrage. And that is fully reflected in the transcript of the parties' negotiations. There are only 3 pages that reflect this discussion. It's very easy. Defense Exhibit 253 from pages 13 to 16 reflects the agreement that every party on all sides agrees was the substance of the agreement. And the parties were talking about arbitrage opportunities where the gas could be redelivered to a different geographic market where a circumstance in that market had led to a spike in the price of gas. And the parties could redirect the gas and derive additional value. It's unambiguous the parties are not talking about upside sharing, as Quiksilver euphemistically puts it, in any increase in the rise of gas. And it's unambiguous that the parties understand they will pursue those arbitrage opportunities only if the circumstance arises and they mutually agree to pursue them.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
You said there was no evidence of fraud, but what about the evidence concerning the J. Aaron Hedge?
I'm glad you asked, Your Honor, because the J. Aaron Hedge is the great red herring in this case. And the key to understanding that is to understand that the financial swap, the hedge, did not control the physical gas at all. The hedge is strictly a financial derivative, and it is based on the price of gas, but it does not in any way encumber the gas itself. And that's literally uncontroverted. And if I may, Your Honor, the best confirmation of that comes from Quiksilver's own briefs, where they accurately make this point. At page 9 of their brief as a cross-appellant, they say, these third-party financial deals between CMS and J. Aaron were paper transactions that did not involve the delivery of any physical molecules of gas. And again, at page 20 of their appellee's brief, footnote 8, they make the same point. That is critical.
I'm thinking in terms that we can all understand, even us who have limited experience with hedges.
Certainly.
Isn't it kind of like a high-low agreement? Isn't it just kind of like, okay, your income is capped at this, but your losses are also limited?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a fair characterization. And the key is that because the parties were thinking in terms of arbitrage opportunities where they could deliver the gas to derive additional value, and the hedge was in no way limiting their use of the gas, CMS could have done both. And it was perfectly consistent for CMS.
It could have, but wouldn't it have still limited the profit margin?
No, Your Honor.
Wouldn't the hedge have limited the...
No, absolutely not. And again, the evidence, I think, is uncontradicted on this, and I'll give some record citations you can look at in a moment. But to explain, the hedge capped the profit margin with reference to the Michigan index price of gas. But the whole essence of physical arbitrage is that in certain locations, the price could peak to higher prices than the index. And the parties could have agreed to redirect the gas to that location to take advantage of that premium price. And they could have shared the profit on that premium price while CMS still complied with its hedge, the financial derivative, locking in the profit margin with respect to the index. Now, let me give you the citations that will bear that out, because I understand that it's a unusual financial derivative to... I was a historian before I became a lawyer. It's a little bit outside of my pay grade, but it's very clearly explained in the record. Here's some citations. First of all, volume 4 of the record at page 197 is where Mr. Darden, the Quicksilver principal, himself acknowledges it is in no way tied to the gas. Volume 6 at pages 45 to 53 is where Mr. Shumway, the Quicksilver expert on this issue, agrees no tie to the gas. And then in volume 8 of the record, there's a series of discussion where the CMS representatives explain how the hedge works. I'll just give you the citations. Pages 36 to 48, 53, 171 to 75, 186 to 88, and 194 to 202. What you'll see in those record citations is exactly what Quicksilver has recognized in its briefs. The hedge is in no way tied to the gas. And importantly, and I think this is very important, everyone in the gas industry hedges these types of long-term gas transactions because of the volatility. The record is unambiguous on that. Quicksilver hedges as well. And in fact, one of Quicksilver's negotiators who was on this call, Mike Ryan, testified he absolutely knew from what was said in that transaction that CMS was hedging, and that Toby Darden had to have known it as well, because Darden is sophisticated in the gas industry. That is Court Exhibit 4 at pages 15 to 17. Now, why is that critical to the fraud theory? It's critical to the fraud theory because the entire premise of Quicksilver's fraud claim is that CMS made a promise it never intended to perform. And they think the hedge allows them to infer that we never intended to perform. But when you recognize that the hedge is a complete red herring because it doesn't interfere with the physical gas and the ability to pursue the arbitrage opportunities that the parties were discussing, then it's apparent there's absolutely no inference that CMS didn't perform. In fact, it's just to the contrary. CMS would never have entered into the kind of upsharing agreement that Quicksilver alleges while it was simultaneously hedging. Of course, the key for the fraud claim is they have to prove not just how they wanted to interpret that agreement, but that CMS itself understood the agreement the same way and did not intend to perform it. And there is literally not one scintilla of evidence in this record that establishes that basic proposition. And I think you will see today an effort in a moving target way to come up with new citations about intent to defraud. And I invite the court, study the record on those citations, and you will see nothing but a dispute over the meaning of the contract, which MEGA controls, Your Honor.
Well, regardless of the of whether the hedge did have anything to do with or preventing any arbitrage deals. It seems to me that Quiksilver is taking the position that CMS claimed that it was prevented from performing because of the hedge.
Yes, they are taking that position. And, Your Honor, I'm delighted you asked the question because we never have taken that position. Never have taken that position. We have invariably said we can perform under the hedge and perform the agreement we believe we made to pursue arbitrage opportunities. If you look at their record citations, what you will see is the CMS witnesses say, we can't just take advantage of upside in the rising index price of gas because of the hedge. But that's not what we understood the agreement to be. We have never once said the hedge prevents us from performing as we understand the agreement, and I want to emphasize, as the jury understood the agreement. Remember, the jury answered the condition precedent question in favor of CMS. The theory that there was a failure of a condition precedent was that this agreement was a reference to pursuing arbitrage opportunities and that neither party had ever identified the arbitrage opportunity, and so there was not an occasion for performance. The jury answered that favorably to CMS. We won this verdict on the meaning of the agreement. And if you look at volume 10 of the record at pages 81 to 82, you will see Mr. Redden's closing argument that explains precisely that theory of the condition precedent, which the jury adopted. Now, where did that leave Quiksilver at the end of the day? They had lost their contract theory. They got this admittedly curious fraud finding after 5 days of deliberation, but they got a zero damages verdict. And because they had knowingly elected to condition the rescission questions on the contract theory, because they knew they really had a contract case, they hadn't gotten the findings they needed under this court's prior decision on rescission. And so they were forced to try and make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. What they did for the first time after verdict is come up with a theory that they could rescind the contract based solely on fraud. Everyone had known through this case that was not true. The court had held in the summary judgment appeal mutual mistake or unilateral mistake induced by fraud. We submitted questions to the jury that related to those theories. We debated vigorously the content of those questions. They absolutely knew they needed those findings to rescind. They didn't get the findings, but when they gambled and lost on their damage theory, then they popped up with this rescission theory after verdict. Now, the trial judge ultimately decided to give them prospective rescission from the date of judgment forward. That essentially gave Quiksilver a $37 million windfall in this case, with the value of the gas that remains available under the base contract in a case where the jury found Quiksilver had suffered zero damages. But the judge refused to give them the additional $150 million windfall that would be obtained if they had rescission from day one of the contract. Remember, this is a company that has taken $69 million of revenue from CMS over 8 years, standing by this contract and electing the benefits of the contract, and then tried to walk away from it. The trial judge had every reason, in light of extensive delay in failing to give any indication of a desire to rescind the contract, the failure ever to make an attender of that $69 million back, and the speculative nature of Quiksilver's behavior here in speculating on the gas market and taking advantage of a risk-free ride up the rising price of the gas market while it was accepting $69 million in revenue from us, to say that is inequitable. And in balancing the equities, the court in its discretion said if there's any basis for rescission in this case, the only basis would be prospective rescission. That's certainly not an abuse of discretion, but the court shouldn't even need to reach the cross appeal if you correctly hold either that there's no evidence of intent to defraud. And I urge the court, this case is as squarely controlled by Miga versus Jensen and the Tony Gullo case as any case you will see, or if you recognize that they failed to get the rescission findings that this court recognized would be necessary to rescind the base contract. Either of those are independent grounds to reverse the judgment and render a judgment in favor of CMS. If the court has no further questions, I think I've fully presented our position, and I'll defer to counsel and wait for rebuttal.
Any questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. This case, and particularly this panel, is familiar with this suit as it previously reversed and remanded a summary judgment, noting that there were fact issues related to Quicksilver's claim for breach of contract and fraud. CMS has taken the position that we're here on an entirely different set of circumstances than we were 3 years ago. In actuality, the only different circumstances are the change in CMS's positions and the fact that you have before you a much more full record confirming that CMS, as the jury found, breached the contract and committed a fraud. Now, the issues before this court are fivefold. First, what law applies? As to that particular issue, it only has an impact as to the punitive damage finding. As CMS has told you, the jury found $10 million in punitive damages. Those damages were not awarded. Unlike CMS, I can't jump into the jury's mind and tell you here's how they thought things, which, as you've seen, CMS has done both in its briefing and in its argument. What I can tell you is there's a $10 million finding that the trial court apparently did not allow Quicksilver to recover because it felt Michigan law applied. And Quicksilver concedes that that's the one issue where the choice of law matters. Now, first of all, what does the choice of law provision actually provide? It's a very narrow choice of law provision, and we've given the panel handouts as well as that we have this blow-up. All it says is it'll govern the contract. Well, remember that the fraud finding is not a finding based upon the contract. It's a finding based upon fraud. So that reason in and of itself would not allow this provision to control. The next issue is once you have a fraud finding, the contract is void. It was rescinded. It's as if it never existed. Without existence, you then go back to a typical choice of law analysis. And in this case, where does that analysis get you? Well, first of all, we know that the representations were made to Quicksilver while Quicksilver was in Fort Worth, Texas. The representations were relied upon Quicksilver while Quicksilver was in Fort Worth, Texas. The confirmation letter was sent to Quicksilver in Fort Worth, Texas. The contract was sent to Quicksilver in Fort Worth, Texas. And the contract was signed by Quicksilver in Fort Worth, Texas. The injury occurred to Quicksilver in Fort Worth, Texas. And both CMS and Quicksilver have Texas presence. Based upon a normal choice of law analysis, there's only one law that can apply, and that's Texas law. And again, I stress it only matters as to the punitive damage finding. Now, CMS claims that there was absolutely no evidence of fraud. And CMS claimed that the hedging, it was always its position that the hedging had no effect on these molecules of gas. You need look no further than Justice Walker's own opinion in this case to know that wasn't CMS's position 3 years ago, and it wasn't CMS's position at trial. If you look at your decision, Justice Walker, the very beginning of it, you took note from the record then, that limited record, that, and it's at the very beginning, after suit was filed, CMS disclosed that prior to entering into the agreement with Quicksilver, it had negotiated a, quote, back-to-back, quote, closed financial hedge with respect to gas covered by the Quicksilver contract supply, capping CMS's effective financial recovery on the gas it purchased from Quicksilver. And Justice Walker, the reason you were able to make note of that, because it was in the summary judgment record, but more importantly, when you go back to this trial record, you need go no further than Defendant's Exhibit 274, a letter from CMS, where CMS specifically said that, as you know, CMS entered into a hedging transaction which limits the profits that CMS can make from Quicksilver's gas. You need look no further, excuse me, than David Geyer's testimony, wherein I cross-examined Mr. Geyer at 8 of the reporter's record, page 227, and asked, and with respect to the swaps, exhibits 34 and 37, those don't involve physical molecules of gas, do they? Well, I think they do. They and the stutter's there, I'm not stuttering now. They hedge the physical molecules of gas that we purchase from Quicksilver. Their expert said the same thing, Patrice Ferguson at 9 Reporters Record, page 34, that there was a cap of 7 cents profit on this gas because of the financial hedge. That's the reason that the jury could choose to believe or disbelieve CMS's position. It was like the wind. It mattered which way it blew, depending upon what they needed to say at that point in time. Now, what's CMS's burden to overturn the original rescission? On a legal sufficiency challenge, it's clear that they have to show a complete absence of evidence, that the court is barred by rules from considering the evidence that was admitted, or that the evidence offered to prove a vital fact is no more than a scintilla, and finally, that the evidence establishes conclusively the alternative of what the jury found. Just the cites I gave you would be sufficient to show they can't meet that burden. It's interesting because if you look at CMS's briefing, it relies very heavily on something that has absolutely nothing to do with the record evidence or the law this court has to apply. It relies very heavily on a statement I made in closing, but in doing so, it ignores the predicate statement and it ignores the ending statement. What if you look at the totality of the closing, which again I don't think this court even has to do, but if you do because they spent so much time on it, what you see is what I said, and again I quote, is that my mom and dad always taught me to think of the best of people, and then I went on trying to think of the best of people. Then I realized this was one of those circumstances, no matter how much I want to listen to mom and dad, I can't because these people did some bad things. And I said, because of that, and I went through the evidence, and we've got a blow up that shows some of the evidence I went through, saying, you need to find a fraud. And in particular, it was easy to find the fraud because CMS's position, as I said, changed constantly. There was an inquiry by Quicksilver. There may be some opportunities for both of us to use the supply on some of these wide fluctuations of gas. CMS unequivocally said, oh, absolutely. And as shown in the blow up as well as in y'all's handout, if it's what it meant is what it now says it meant, it should have said the things in the right-hand column. And I won't take the time because I know we're limited on time, but each of those side entries supports the fact that there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to find fraud. Now, moving to the intent element. MEGA has absolutely nothing to do with this case. As I'm sure this court is aware, MEGA involved a stock option, and the question was really twofold in MEGA. Was the stock option terminated at the time the employee's employment was terminated, and or was that option released as part of a settlement, as part of a release? It wasn't that they were saying that you had a difference in interpretation when you made the promise. It's they're saying circumstances change, so now it's the interpretation as it always was that matters. CMS's interpretation of this upside sharing provision has always been the same in one way, and that's that we're not bound by it. Now, the reasoning for not being bound by it has changed constantly. As you probably recall, 3 years ago when we were here, one of the reasons was the provision is illusory, it's unenforceable, and it can't have any meaning. Another reason was even if it had meaning, you can't apply it because the hedge trumps it. Now it's the hedge doesn't mean anything, it's not necessarily illusory, and we could have applied it, but it was under this very limited set of circumstances. But if you go back to the record cites, that's not what they testified to. So as for MEGA, has little to nothing to do with this case. In fact, it's interesting that the phrase smoking gun was used, because what all of the courts have said is it's rare that you find that smoking gun. And because of that, you have to be able to base a fraud finding upon circumstantial evidence. And you look at the entirety of the position. Quicksilver agrees. The fact alone that CMS did not honor its promise would not be sufficient to show fraud. But it's a factor that the jury could and did consider in determining that fraud didn't exist.
So do you equate the position of not being bound by the promise with a denial that a promise existed? Do you understand what I'm saying? That if there's evidence that the defendant denied that a promise existed, that might be some evidence of fraud or to show that they had no intent to perform the promise at the time it was made. And you're saying that they contend they were not bound by the promise. Is that equivalent?
Evidence, Your Honor. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you. And I'm going to mispronounce this. Spurgeolic, and I know I'm mispronouncing it, clearly says that you look at all those factors. So I don't think that's not even a big issue before this court. I don't think even CMS is willing to go so far as to say it's not something you look at. They just say here there's not enough to look at, which is interesting, again, because if you look at CMS's brief on page 37, they seem to go topsy-turvy on what the burdens are here. And on that particular page, CMS acknowledges that Quicksilver's CEO, Toby Darden, testified that he would not have entered into the contract absent CMS's promise to share the upside. In other words, the reliance element that they claim there's no evidence on. And then they go on to state the jury was free to disbelieve him. Well, that's true. The jury was free to disbelieve Toby. They could have thought, I don't believe him, and based on the entirety of the evidence, I think there is no reliance. But that's evidence of reliance, and the jury was equally free to believe him. And it did believe him, because remember that the fraud finding specifically, the issue submitted on fraud specifically, first of all, was on a clear and convincing standard. It wasn't just a preponderance of the evidence. And two, it had to show injury. So we know that we've got an injury finding here. And I'm going to backtrack. That's another reason why the $10 million in punitive damages is appropriate, because one of the concerns is whether or not the cap would apply. We don't have that concern. We've cited numerous cases, and in particularly the Texas Capital case in the, I'll get you the correct site in a second, that specifically state in a rescission situation, you may award punitive damages even if there's no monetary damages. The concern being under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, whether the cap would prohibit the award that was given. Well, that concern is done away with because we have a judicial admission that the rescission value is a minimum, and again, it depends on which brief you want to read and which day of the week it is, a minimum of $37 million, as much as possibly $40 million. And if we move forward to the retroactive rescission, which we believe is appropriate and I'll address, then you get $150 million. So the punitive damages are clearly appropriate. The Lindman and Tony Guerra cases are not nearly as broad as CMS wants this court to believe. And interestingly, in both of those cases, the fraud findings were upheld. So they suggest that in order to have fraud, you have to have the smoking gun and you have to have this admission. And neither of those cases say that. What both of those cases say is generally, you have some admission. And if you don't, you still can rely upon circumstantial evidence to get there. Well, in this case, you actually do have a tacit admission by CMS if you look at the record in its entirety. What CMS says, both Andrew Coppola and Mark Poley, is that some performance, and it's on the third handout in the blowout, some performance is due under the upside sharing clause. We owe you performance. So they admitted that the clause existed. They admitted that they knew they owed performance under it, and then they failed to perform. So you actually have a like amount of admission as you do in both the Lindman and Tony Gallo Motors cases. So not only do they not support CMS's position, they actually confirm that the fraud finding is appropriate in this case. Now, with respect to it being unreasonable for Toby to have relied upon the statements, because in the original phone conversation, the phrase, "we can't guarantee," was used. And if you look at CMS's briefing, that phrase shows up several times, and it's stressed and emphasized. But again, you've got to look at the entirety of that conversation. And actually, that phrase supports the reasonableness of the reliance. The statement, "we cannot guarantee," doesn't repudiate CMS's promise or make it unreasonable. It confirms that what CMS said is that although we can't promise this will be the very first molecule we deliver, when it's available, and we know it was because the record is replete with tons of cells showing that they sold this gas almost every single month and almost every single day for prices much above the $2.47, that we're committed to sharing that upside with you. They failed to do so. So not only does the "we cannot guarantee" statement not support CMS's position, it supports the jury's findings that it was reasonable to rely upon that statement and the entirety of the circumstances to find that reliance in itself was reasonable. CMS also relies upon an email from Thad Shumway to suggest that, well, Thad, an employee at the time of Quiksilver, said, "We don't think this means anything." Well, that's not what Thad says the email means. And again, this court is not burdened with the obligation of weighing the credibility of the evidence and making its own fact finding. There is evidence from Thad saying, "No, what I was saying in this email is A, B, and C." There's evidence in the record from CMS saying, "Well, we think the email means D, E, and F." That's conflicting evidence. It's still enough to support the jury's verdict. Now, the final element that CMS relies upon is it says there's no material misrepresentation whatsoever. How can you contend with a straight face it's not a material misrepresentation and at the same time come before this panel and say, look, if it means what we thought it means, and if you keep intact just the portion of the judgment that the court has entered, we're damaged $37 to $40 million. That's very material. Conversely, if you allow the wrongdoer, the person who committed fraud, CMS, to get away with this, Quiksilver's out $37 to $40 million. So it's very material. That brings us to the cross point. Why should retroactive rescission have been granted? Well, first of all, we know we've got a fraud finding. We know that that fraud was based upon clear and convincing evidence, and we know that the jury found there was injury to Quiksilver. There was no delay on Quiksilver's part. Quiksilver constantly pursued its claims. And it's also somewhat disingenuous to say that there was never a rescission claim or a fraud claim until the very end, because Justice Walker, in your original opinion, you discussed the fraud claim. That fraud claim was pending for years, and there was a broad prayer as part of that fraud claim. As cited in the brief, a fraud claim coupled with a broad prayer, unless a special exception is asserted, is sufficient to impose a rescission remedy. In fact, had Quiksilver desired to put all of its eggs in one basket, all it would have had to have done is submit the fraud issue, period. Had it elected to do that, it then would have been able to and ask for either monetary damages or that's it. The rescission is not for a jury to find. That's for the court to award based upon the fraud finding. And once the fraud finding is found, it is the appropriate remedy. And the court's supposed to, in exercising its equity, give the broadest relief possible to the recovering party, Quiksilver. In this instance, the broadest relief possible is the full rescission, not just 20% of the rescission. So in other words, the wrongdoer has received the benefit, even though it acted wrongly for 80% of the time. Quiksilver only gets the benefit for less than 20% of the time. The final issue before this court is related to the bonding requirements. And a bond is discretionary with the court how the trial court's going to issue it. He could have either chosen to say you have to make deliveries and CMS will bond it, or you don't have to make deliveries and Quiksilver will bond it, which is what he chose to do. In doing so, Quiksilver is going to incur in excess of $800,000 in bonding costs. So in order to be made whole, when this court hopefully affirms the judgment plus actually grants the punitive damages that should have been granted and the retroactive rescission, which should have been granted, in order to be made whole, Quiksilver also has to recover its bonding cost. And that's what the judgment currently provides.
I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
You're saying on the fraud question that injury is implied, I guess because of Part D of the jury question, saying the other party reasonably relies on the misrepresentation and thereby suffers injury. So you're saying that injury is implied, but then how do you reconcile that with the zero damages in question four?
Again, well, one, it's not implied. It's specifically found. And two, I can't profess to jump in the jury's mind, but if the court will recall that there was actually a question that came out, it's part of the record, I believe, saying, are we limited to one of the numbers that were presented? And so, in other words, were they limited to zero or the, and I don't remember the exact number, it was 100 and something million dollars. And it appears that they thought they were limited to one or the other and put zero. It doesn't matter, though, Your Honor, because, again, had Quiksilver chosen, it didn't have to submit a dollar damage at all. It could have simply submitted the fraud question, and I don't think anyone will disagree with that. And by simply submitting that fraud question, it would have been entitled to elect rescission.
Any other questions?
Not right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, there's a threshold issue here that makes quick work of the appeal. You'll notice that counsel did not answer or deny that under Michigan law, a finding of unilateral mistake was required for rescission. He has tied his whole case now to the choice of law ruling. He has implicitly admitted to you that if you correctly recognize, as Texas law requires and the N. Ray J.D. Edwards case from the Supreme Court signals, and as the restatement teaches, that Michigan law, as chosen by the choice of law clause, controls this fraudulent inducement claim, he did not get the unilateral mistake finding that is necessary for rescission. You reverse and render the entire judgment on that basis alone without reference to the evidence, without reference to the cross appeal, and the case is over. Now, I want to spend some time talking about the evidence that he has introduced to try and prove intent to defraud. But before I do, I can't allow the arguments about the cross appeal and the request for retroactive rescission to go unanswered. Counsel acknowledged rescission is for the court. Rescission is a discretionary matter for the court, and if you look at the Livingston case from the Michigan Supreme Court and the case decision from the Michigan courts, it recognizes that whether to rescind is a matter for the discretion of the court. Justice Walker, the reason for the zero damages finding that the jury made was very simple. There was ample evidence in the record that Quiksilver had to make a deal for a fixed term at the time they made this deal. They had debt covenants. They had just lost their best customer. They had their own hedging policy. The jury had ample reason to believe if Quiksilver had not made this deal at market prices, they would have made another deal at market prices. They haven't suffered any loss. They've got $69 million of our money, and they have suffered no loss. CMS did delay in seeking rescission. It did not explicitly plead for rescission until 2007. He does not deny that they never have tendered back the $69 million, and you notice he does not even answer the argument that they have speculated on the gas market without risk in direct violation of the Grabendike decision from the Michigan Supreme Court and the Twin Lick Oil decision from the United States Supreme Court. All of those are equitable factors that justify the denial of retroactive rescission. And that is certainly no abuse of discretion. But you need not even reach those issues because there is simply no evidence here of any intent to defraud under MEGA and Tony Gullo. I made a list, and I counted six efforts to show evidence of intent to defraud. Let me just talk to you about them. The first one, he said, PX-274. That is a letter written from CMS principals in 2003, 4 years after this agreement was struck, setting forth CMS's interpretation of the agreement. It doesn't help Quiksilver. It postdates the agreement, and it proves our point. He cites Mr. Geyer's testimony in Volume 8 at 227. That is simply Mr. Geyer explaining his interpretation of this arbitrage agreement and explaining that the hedges provided a financial hedge against the risk related to the gas, does not say at all that the hedge prevents us from pursuing arbitrage opportunities. Justice Walker, I gave you detailed citations earlier to Mr. Geyer's testimony. I invite you to read all of those citations. He cites Volume 9, page 74, our defense expert, who has no personal knowledge of these facts, and her evaluation of this deal. That can't possibly be evidence of intent to defraud when the contract was entered into. He cites CMS's legal positions. And, Justice Gardner, astounded that he answered your argument by saying that a court can take account of a party's legal position in litigation about the meaning of a contract as evidence of intent to defraud. That is absolutely not the law. I think that is unprecedented. And in MEGA, this court actually dealt with that very question and said a dispute over the meaning of the contract and the trial position taken over the meaning of a contract cannot be evidence of fraud. Those legal positions are taken by the lawyers, and they are sound, respectable legal positions, but there's certainly no evidence of the intent of the CMS negotiators at the time the contract was written. Finally, he cites Mr. Shumway's conversations with Polly and with Coppola, and I really want to make this point. Mr. Shumway, and look at this evidence. It's volume 6 of the record at pages 21 to 23 and page 36. Mr. Shumway says after this bargain was struck, he spoke with Mr. Polly and Mr. Coppola about performance, and they explained their understanding of the agreement and that they had not had a specific commitment to engage in upside sharing. It is absolutely the CMS understanding of this agreement from day one. It was an arbitrage agreement. There was never any intent to defraud Quiksilver, and there is no evidence to support this fraud finding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We appreciate both sides being here. Your case is submitted. You are released.
Thank you.
And we'll recess briefly before the 10:30 docket.